det var ju de årene da hun hadde nok så sterke indre brytninger. Indre brytninger.
Hei og velkommen til Noen har snakket sammen. Mitt navn Tiril Rustan Oliversen.
Og jeg heter Aksel Fjellavli.
I dag skal vi snakke med Oliver Bullough, som forfatter av boken som heter Pengeland, eller Moneyland på engelsk, som blir gitt ut på norsk denne uken av forlaget Respublika. I boken så dissekerer Bullough det faktum at 5000 milliarder kroner hvert år forsvinner ut av det regulerte økonomiske systemet, og vi skal snakke om hvorfor det skjer. Og hva det har å si for demokratiet og den økonomiske utviklingen i verden.
Mm. Og etterpå så skal vi også snakke litt grann med Marianne Martinsen fra Arbeiderpartiet, som har skrevet en bok sammen med LO-rådgiver Maria Wahlberg, litt om noen løsninger fra et norsk perspektiv.
Ja, for det er jo når man legger frem statsbudsjett for eksempel, som har blitt gjort denne uken, så blir det jo mye snakk om relativt små beløp, viktige saker riktig nok, men små beløp. Det vi skal snakke om i dag er de store pengene, egentlig.
Big money.
Big money.
Oliver Bullough, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's really good to be here.
So your book that has been translated into Norwegian as is being released right now, it's called in Norwegian Pengeland or Moneyland in English. And this is not a country that many people have heard of maybe, but you say it makes sense to talk of it as a country, sort of. Why do you say Moneyland?
It's came to be as an idea, almost as a joke to begin with, because I was trying to describe how the elite in specifically Ukraine, but I suppose more broadly the former Soviet Union, behave, and the way that essentially it doesn't really matter what happens, they're always okay, right? So they are immune to any kind of legal challenge, they're immune to any kind of challenge of any kind. They get all this money, they've stolen all this money, they stash it in shell companies and offshore financial centers and whatnot, and then they get to run their country and steal more money, but they are themselves immune to all the bad things that they do to other people. So I suppose I was trying to just come up with a way in my head to work out how this happened, and I said, well, they're okay, they live in Moneyland, to myself. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought that actually they did live in Moneyland. It's actually essentially an accurate description of what's happening, because if you are very wealthy, you have access to a whole range of legal tricks and legal defenses that ordinary people can't afford. So essentially, the money of very wealthy people is treated in a different way to the money of ordinary people. And so it seemed to me that a sensible way of looking at that was to say, well, they have their own country, and it's Moneyland, and it's a new kind of country. It's not a country that's defined geographically. You can't find it on a map. It's a country that's everywhere at the same time. So if it's essentially a country that sits on top of all the other countries or underneath all the other countries. It's everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
And it's also a very rich country.
Yeah, I mean, it's as rich as the assets of anyone who wants to be a citizen of it. I mean, it isn't every rich person who's a citizen of Moneyland. You don't have to be. You can only be a citizen if you're rich. And essentially, it means that you pick and choose which laws you follow, because, you know, if you're an ordinary person like us, I suppose, then you spend most of your life in one country. Your money's in one country, you live in one country. You know, you're only really affected by the laws of one country. You might go on holiday somewhere, but really you live in one country. If you're very rich, however, you choose between countries in the same way that ordinary people might choose between which bus to take in the morning or which bank account to put their money in. You know, so you can pick and choose which countries you want depending on what that country can do for you. If you don't want to pay tax, you put your money in the Cayman Islands. If you want, you know, to have your children have a good education, you put your children in England. If you want, you know, your weather to be lovely, you can live in the south of France, whatever. So you pick and choose which country you want, and then all those little bits of those countries add together to create a new country, which is Moneyland.
When I read the book, one like picture that came to my mind was a picture of a restaurant, sort of, where ordinary people has to use a set course menu and have like the laws of the jurisdiction. It's set like a set course menu restaurant, but then you have rich people that has a la carte menu where you can you can choose jurisdictions in the way you like to please you.
That's a fantastic way of describing it. I hadn't thought about it like that, but yeah, essentially it's a system that is only available to people who can afford it. I mean, it's not closed to anyone, right? Anyone has access to it, but most people can't afford it. So it's not that they don't want you. If you were rich, they'd be very happy to have you. But if you're not, then you know, you can't pay for it.
And you can buy anything, even passports and citizenships.
Yeah, visas and passports, citizenship. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary. A lot of this stuff is, I suppose, it's only for the people involved in it. It doesn't seem scandalous because they think it's normal. Mm-hmm. But when you first hear about these things, it seems incredible. You can buy a passport, and it's totally legal. You know, there are countries that do make quite a good living out of selling passports. It began in St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean. Which, you know, started it and did quite well out of it. And then other countries saw they were doing it and started doing it too. So now, I mean, it goes up all the time. I think there's 7 or 8 countries you can buy a passport for. And, you know, it depends how much you want to spend. If you want to spend $100,000, say, you can get a passport from Dominica in the Caribbean or Moldova. They'll sell you a passport. I mean, they're quite good passports, but they're not that good.
Yeah, why are they useful to have?
Because they're not fake.
No, I mean, they're essentially like a super visa. You know, if you are as one gentleman I was talking to is a Palestinian, if you have a Palestinian passport, it's really annoying. You know, you need a visa to go absolutely everywhere. And if you are a wealthy Palestinian, that's profoundly annoying. You know, all your friends are rich and they can go where they like, but you can't. So you buy a St. Kitts and Nevis passport and suddenly you have visa-free access to dozens and dozens of countries, which you wouldn't have had before. But now you can buy a passport from Malta or Cyprus, and that's brilliant. You're buying EU citizenship. But I mean, this is often, in wealthy countries, we beat up on poor countries for doing this, whether that's St. Kitts and Nevis or Dominica or Moldova, and say, you know, how can they break the rules like this? But rich countries have been selling visas for decades. You know, it started off in Canada, then the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia. Almost every rich country now sells, even France sells visas. It's just normal now. But we don't think about it. We don't talk about it. It's just part of life now that if you're rich, you don't have to stand in the queue like anyone else. You don't have to pass the test like everyone else. You just buy it, and then that's fine. I mean, in Britain until, a couple of years ago, they didn't even check where the money came from. Just buy a visa. Yeah, thanks very much. It's £1 million.
Yeah. So, like more in general, what would you say the role of the rich countries is in this Moneyland system? Because, you would usually think of like tax havens, like paradise islands with the palms and beaches and so on. But a lot of your book is also about like Great Britain and things that happens there. In what way are they taking part in that system?
Well, I mean, in a sort of Moneyland sense, there are countries have different roles. You've got countries where the money comes from. These are, you know, you could almost think of them as colonies of Moneyland. These are places like Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Nigeria, Angola, Venezuela. These are places where, you know, it's if you are in power, it's easy to steal because there are no institutions to stop you. So you can steal whatever you like. Once you've stolen the money, though, right, you're rich, and you're rich in Azerbaijan. There's a risk, because there's no institutions, that someone else can just steal the money that you've stolen. You don't want that money that you've spent so much time and effort stealing to be stolen from you, so you want to put it somewhere else, right? Now, where you really want to put it is somewhere where it's nice to spend money, right? So the United States, it's great to spend money. Look at all the good things you can buy. Or Switzerland, France, the United Kingdom, Norway. These are good places to spend money because look at all the great stuff you can buy on the street. Look at the lovely houses you can buy, good schools to send your kids to and stuff. But the problem is that these places have rules that stop you. Nominally, they're supposed to stop you taking dirty stolen money and just spending it there. You know, they don't like gangsters just taking stolen money and spending it in the shops. So how do you transform the dirty money that you've stolen in Angola into clean money that you can buy a £10 million house with in London? How are you going to do that? That's what Moneyland does for you. And Moneyland involves, you move it through lots of different jurisdictions. You own it via a shell company in the British Virgin Islands. You move it via a bank in Estonia. And once you've moved it through five different jurisdictions, no one even knows where the money came from anymore. You can't.
Because it's so complex.
It's so complex, you can't tell. It's anonymous money. It doesn't even belong to you now. It belongs to an investment company in the Cayman Islands. Mm. You know, and that is the joy that Moneyland gives you. Because it's all, there have always been corrupt people, right? As long as there's been power, there's been people who abused power. That's, you know, obvious. But it didn't used to be possible to move money from the place where it's stolen to somewhere completely different where you can spend it. Before money was money, it was in a bag or in a box. You could bury it in the ground and that was pretty much all you could do with it. If you spent it, it was obvious you'd stolen it. Whereas now it's magic. You steal all this money and then it just goes out there into the international financial system. It becomes a string of ones and zeros. Your name is stripped off it and then it pops up in London or Oslo or Paris or New York and then you can spend it on wonderful bling. It's an astonishing system which just makes theft incredibly easy. And one of my favorite academic studies is a study of supermarkets in the UK after they changed from having a system whereby you bought your goods from a person to when you buy your goods from a machine. You just scan them yourself and then you pay with your card and then you walk out. And they took these supermarkets, they changed them to having a machine, and it's the same supermarkets with the same customers in the same town. And theft went up 100%, doubled, just because you weren't checking with a person anymore. Mm. Now, I think what that shows us is that theft is a crime of opportunity. If it's easy to steal, people will steal. If it's difficult to steal, people won't steal. What we've created with Moneyland is a system whereby it's incredibly easy to steal. Mm. You know, you'd be stupid not to steal. There is no downside to stealing. You know, the chance of your money being caught and taken away from you and given back to the people you stole it from, it's less than 1%. It's a fraction of 1%. So just steal. I mean, why not?
All the money or all the rich people in the world, they didn't get rich by stealing necessarily, but I think...
Well, this is, to my mind, where Moneyland becomes really interesting. Because if you're looking at, say, the president of Angola or the president of Equatorial Guinea, someone who lives in a profoundly poor country and yet who has a fortune bigger than the Queen of England, right? You can tell that that is clearly dishonest, right? That's just obvious that that's dishonest. That's the far extreme of Moneyland. And then you've got, a sort of Bill Gates, right? Someone like that who, you know, they've just built a good computer program that people want and they've got rich. That's the opposite extreme. That's fine, right? That's normal. Mm. But in between those two people, there is an entire spectrum of different shades of gray. And what makes it so interesting is that there isn't a point where someone goes from being a kleptocrat to someone goes from being an honest businessman. There is no person you can say that is the point at which it's fine. Because from kleptocracy, the sort of Putin behavior, you then go into tax evasion, extreme tax evasion, which is illegal, but it uses exactly the same tricks. It uses the same jurisdictions. It's the same mechanisms. The money is moved by the same people in the same way. And then from tax evasion, it's just a short hop into tax avoidance, which is legal, but it's exactly the same thing. It's just legal. So that the money is moved in the same way by the same people in the same jurisdictions. And then from tax avoidance, you go into ordinary legitimate business practice. The money is still moved in the same way by the same people in the same jurisdictions. It's just for different purposes. And that's what's so interesting about Moneyland, is that Moneyland was born in the early 1960s in this alliance between Swiss banks and London bankers. And the Swiss banks had huge amounts of money that had been stashed in them, in the banks, by Europeans who wanted to dodge taxes and by kleptocrats who'd stolen money from their national treasuries. And it was just sitting in the bank. And the London bankers invented this thing called offshore, this system which meant that money could be borderless and free and could be spent anywhere in a totally anonymous way. And the money that went into that first ever form of Moneyland, the things called the Eurobonds, was partly tax evading money, which was illegal, but kind of naughty rather than evil, and partly kleptocratic stolen money, which is evil money. But the very beginning, they were mixed together. So this question of, you know, what about, you know, wealthy Westerners? What about, you know, kleptocrats? They essentially are using exactly the same networks. And I think this is why it's so hard to do something about Moneyland, because the wealthy Westerners who use the same tricks in order to minimize their taxes or evade taxes altogether, they are very well connected in our societies. These are, you know, they are wealthy people with influence, and they make it very hard to change the system.
But would you say you took Bill Gates as an example, say Serena Williams, the tennis player, rich person. And if she creates a complex structure of shell companies and like puts her money into Moneyland, so to say, is she doing something immoral? Is she upholding the system for like the incentive structures of stealing, so to say?
Well, I'm guessing that Serena Williams, who I admire enormously, wouldn't do anything like that. But but let's say there was someone who did. Let's call them Person X, who, unlike Serena Williams, behaved badly, because she obviously behaves impeccably. If someone uses a scheme to minimize their taxes, right, if they're well advised, that scheme can be created in such a way to make it legal to evade taxes, to avoid taxes. So you say you avoid taxes if it's legal, you evade them if it's illegal. But essentially, you're doing the same thing. All you're doing is a scheme that was a tax avoidance scheme, if the law is changed, becomes a tax evasion scheme. But all of these things, if you think about what these people are doing, is they are avoiding the responsibilities everyone has as a citizen. Right? I have a son who's six. And at school, they have a sort of game they play, or sort of, it's essentially to try and teach everyone to be nice. And the idea is that they have a bucket in the middle of the classroom, and everyone is supposed to be a pourer in to the bucket instead of a dipper. If you pour in happiness, you say if you help people, if you open the door for people, if you're nice to people, if you give them a hug if they're crying, all this, you are pouring happiness into the bucket. If you're someone who hits people and bullies people and is nasty and shouts people, then you're a dipper and you take happiness out. Now, it's obvious a child can understand it's better to be a pourer in than a dipper, right? Everyone should be a pourer in and not a dipper. And yet we have a whole stratum of people around the world, you know, whether it's rich, the shareholders of rich companies, or just rich individuals, who are happy to avoid taxes and dodge their responsibilities as citizens, who think it's acceptable to be dippers and not pourers in, because that's what they think that it's okay to be. But, you know, but civilization or democracy, It's a contract between everyone. Everyone has rights. We have rights. We have, you know, the right to a free trial and the right to representation and so on. And we have responsibilities. And the responsibility is that we pay our taxes, that we take a full part in society. If you only do one of those things, then you're a dipper. You're not pouring in. We need to do all of these things. If you don't pay your fair share in taxes, then you can't claim to be a citizen.
And you, as I understand, you also put lawyers, consultants, people who help people avoid taxes, also in this dipper group.
Absolutely. I mean, you are essentially undermining civilization, right? If you look at what anyone does and say, if everyone behaved like that, would civilization function? If everyone behaved like lawyers who create shell companies for kleptocrats, could civilization function? No, it couldn't. Everything would fall apart, right? If you are undermining the basis of a decent society, then you're a dipper. And I've got no time for dippers. So, you know, this is the problem. Moneyland, the structure of Moneyland, the scaffolding of Moneyland is the shell companies. And shell companies are created by lawyers and accountants and company formation agents, all these people who deliberately help people dodge the rules which are created to keep us all safe. And it's a little bit sort of hard to describe, because the amount of money we're talking about is so enormous. But if you look at theft, right, if you have just someone who steals mobile phones on the street, right, we recognize that if someone steals mobile phones on the street, they are a criminal. But the person, the shop that accepts the mobile phone and gives them, you know, I don't know what the going rate is for mobile phones in this country, I don't know, 200 kroner or whatever, you know, on the street, you know, that person is as much a criminal as the original thief, because without the person who's turning that stolen mobile phone into cash, the original theft wouldn't happen. We know this. So, but what we seem to have forgotten this in terms of, you know, massive grand corruption, giant fraud, that it isn't just about the person who steals the money in the first place, but the person who turns that money into clean money is as much a criminal as the original criminal is, the original thief, because without their services, without the lawyers and the accountants and the company formation agents and tax havens and so on, no one would steal the money in the first place, because you don't steal money if you can't keep it. I mean, that would be stupid. You know, it's you only steal money if you can enjoy it and spend it on yachts and you know, Swarovski crystals and whatnot.
I think we have established quite clearly now that this is immoral. But if we take the second step, can you describe what is the worst consequences of this immoral behavior? Like, what does it look like?
It's again, it's much easier to see the consequences in a poor countries with weak institutions, because it's much more blatant there. I mean, the consequences happen everywhere, you know, where people dodge taxes, then public services are denuded, hospitals don't have enough money and so on. But, you know, everything kind of staggers along in Western countries, things, especially Norway, everything's great here, as far as I could tell. But things stagger along, things are okay. But the in somewhere like Ukraine, where I spent a lot of time, where there's a lot of corruption in particularly public procurement, you know, buying medicines for hospitals. Mm. You know, those medicines would be bought via shell companies in Cyprus, which would deliberately inflate prices by, you know, 100% or whatever, which means there isn't enough money in the budget to buy all the medicines that are needed. Mm. I have a friend in Kiev called Nina, who has a daughter called Nona, and Nona has hemophilia. So this is a disease, if you cut yourself, you keep bleeding. Now, it's very easily treatable. It's just it's a treatable condition in any developed country now. But because the money was being stolen from the hospitals, there wasn't enough clotting factor for Nona, so it just didn't exist, which meant that if ever Nona cut herself, then she had to be rushed to hospital, and they would just hope that there was the medicine she needed. Can you imagine living like that? You know, your 7-year-old daughter is one cut away from death all of the time. You're living, your whole life is suspended all the time, and that is only because of corruption. It's because of Moneyland, the fact that people in the health ministry were stealing all the money that should have gone for this medicine. And that is, you know, you can say it's a white collar crime, it's just financial crime. It's not. It's murder. You know, there are fortunately now Nona is alive, and the healthcare procurement system has improved in Ukraine, so there is the medicine she needs. She's alive, she'll be okay. But there are an awful lot of children that aren't, that never made it because of this. And they're dead because of Moneyland. And it is, you know, it's incredibly sad that there isn't greater recognition of this problem, and you know, it's blood on all of our hands, really.
But when we are talking about, I mean, Ukraine is one story, but if we talk about, say, Somalia or like failed states in different on different points of the spectrum, wouldn't there have been like systemic corruption anyways without the Moneyland system?
There is there has always been corruption, right? But if you look at how much can be stolen from a society before the society falls apart, right? You know, it's, I mean, I'd have much it is. I mean, if you are going to live in a society and your money is in that society, you don't want the society to fall apart, because then there'll just be a revolution and everything will be ripped apart around you and you'll probably be killed, right? Mm. So there is always going to be a limit on how much you will steal if your money is still in that society, right? There has to be. Mm. However, if you can, by pressing a magic button, remove the money from that society and send it to London or New York or Paris, right? You don't care anymore, right? If Somalia falls apart, well, whatever. In fact, you probably want to steal even more quickly, because someone else is stealing too. So the quicker you steal, that means the more you get before the place falls apart. Mm. So it takes away this limit that there used to be on, yes, you might treat a society badly, you might rule it cruelly, but there'll be a limit on how much you stole, because if you stole a huge amount of money, then eventually there'll be a revolution and you'd be killed, right? It's not a very good limit, but it's a limit. Whereas now there isn't any limit at all. Mm. So you just steal as much as you like. If the place falls apart, well, it's fallen apart. Mm. It doesn't matter.
Your book is a book about, well, crooks in essence. But not only that, it's about very powerful crooks that are walking around in our societies. Have you been afraid at any point writing this book?
I mean, I get rude letters from lawyers, which is quite serious in the UK, because we've got very strict defamation laws. That's a bit stressful, because you worry about, you know, a lawsuit and losing all your money. My wife gets angry with me when I get one of those. But no, I haven't been scared. I mean, I used to be not for very long, but I used to be a war reporter. And so I know what it's like to be really scared. Yeah. And this isn't like that. You know, to be honest, if ever I feel a bit scared by it, I just remember what it's like to be hiding behind a wall while bullets hitting the other side of it. And I think, well, this is fine. You know, it's fine. I can stop at any time, right? You know, whereas, you know, I'm not reliant on someone stopping shooting. It's fine. Mm.
Where should we look for solutions? I know the EU is working and the OECD probably, but what kind of solutions and where, who's working on it?
The most important thing, well, there's two important things. The first important thing is we need to know who owns what, right? It's too easy to hide ownership now. And if it's you can hide ownership, then that means you can hide theft. So we need to know who owns what. You know, there, some of the European countries, Norway, Denmark, the UK, have made a bit of progress in terms of publishing who owns companies, which is good. It's impartial and it's imperfect, but it's good. It's a start. We need to go much further in terms of we need to know who owns trusts and foundations and things like that. But, you know, progress is being made. But to be honest, in a way, this isn't really a question of what the rules are. We've got lots of good rules. You know, theft is illegal already. We're not enforcing the rules. You know, the European, I mean, American enforcement is, ironically, American enforcement is quite good. American regulations are quite bad. Whereas in Europe, it's the other way around. European enforcement is terrible, genuinely terrible. And, you know, we need to get much, much, much better at putting people in prison. The thing that really would really change lawyers and accountants' behavior is if they went to prison. You know, a little goes a long way, right? If you are like a leading lawyer in Norway or anywhere, and you know, a leading figure in society, and everyone respects you and you get nodded to whenever you go to the theater and everything, if you get arrested and put in prison, that is going to seriously change other people's behavior because they don't want that to happen to them. So what I want to see is more crooks going to prison. That would make me happy. You know, yes, it would be nice to have better rules, but you know what? We've already got quite good rules. It's time that we started enforcing them better. And right now, you know, enforcement is pathetically underfunded.
Oliver Bellow, thank you so much for coming here. Good luck with your book launch. I can thank see you. The book is in store already. So
it's yeah, it is.
Just to go buy it.
It's great. It's I've been to two bookshops and they both had it. And I'm very happy to be here in Oslo. And I'm soon going to be in Stavanger, and I'm going to be happy to be there too.
Stavanger is a nice city.
So I hear. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So good luck, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Da sitter jeg her på Jungstorget med Marianne Martinsen, som stortingsrepresentant for Arbeiderpartiet. Du har også skrevet en bok om skatt og folk som kanskje ikke betaler så mye skatt som de burde ha gjort. Men du har en litt annen innfallsvinkel enn Oliver Bollo. Kan ikke du forklare det?
Jo, det kan jeg prøve å forklare. Bollo har jo skrevet en bok, en ganske sjokkerende bok egentlig, som først og fremst tar for seg de skikkelige skurkene. Den boka som jeg har skrevet sammen med Maria Wahlberg handler jo om selskapene, altså de internasjonale, flernasjonale selskapenes strategier for å unngå å betale skatt. Men dette ganske beslektet temaer, for det vi ser hvordan de rene kriminelle i større og større grad tar etter selskapene. Altså de later som at de selskaper og bruker mange av de samme arrangementene og disse mekanismene som utvikles av selskapene for å unngå skatt, for å kunne skjule pengene sine, utbytte fra hvitvasking eller hva det måtte være.
Litt av det på en måte grunnleggende problemet som Bollo beskriver jo det at man har lovsystemer som nasjonale, som regulerer hvordan ting skal skattlegges og så videre. Sånn at når man tenker på løsninger, så det åpenbart at her ligger mye av svaret i det internasjonale. Men hva den eventuelle internasjonale løsningen?
Ja, det kommer litt an på om man snakker om kriminalitet eller skatteplanlegging igjen. Men jeg tror alle enige om at grunnleggende sett så må dette løses internasjonalt. Og da det jo flere diskusjoner som går om hvordan den løsningen skal se ut på skatteområdet, så denne ideen om enhetlig skattelegging etter hvert blitt veldig populær, som jo handler om at selskapet beskattes på konsernnivå, så det spiller ingen rolle hvor du gjør av overskuddet ditt, og så fordeles skatten etter et eller annet slags formular etterpå. Jeg tror nok det veldig langt fram for en sånn løsning, og den ikke helt uten svakheter. Så det sporet på skatteområdet som de fleste nok setter sin lit til nå, foregår i OECD. Det et sånt spor som dreier seg om å forklare hva som skal til for at et selskap faktisk kan bli skattlagt. At et land har rett til å skattlegge et selskap, selv om det ikke fysisk til stede i det landet det opererer. Så sånne prosesser går hele tiden, og når det gjelder de rene kriminelle, så har for eksempel EU utviklet en del regelverk, felles regelverk på hvitvasking. hvor vi avhengig av at land utveksler informasjon for å kunne holde tritt med hvordan pengene faktisk beveger seg. Men dette prosesser som tar ganske lang tid, og det ganske uklart hvordan de til syvende og sist blir seende ut om vi i det hele tatt kommer i mål. Så mye av fokuset i vår bok, eller egentlig nesten hele fokuset, handler om forslag til tiltak som det mulig å sette verk i Norge nå, og som ikke på noen som helst slags måte ødelegger for de internasjonale prosessene, men i beste fall kan være med på å støtte opp under dem og gi gode eksempler på hvordan ting kan løses. Og mye av det handler for eksempel om mer finansiell åpenhet.
Ja, det var egentlig mitt neste spørsmål. Liksom disse nasjonale løsningene som skal til, hva vi skal gjøre i mellomtiden mens vi venter på om det nå OECD eller om det EU eller hva det åpenhet, sier du, men det andre sånne spor som viktige å følge?
I vår bok så har vi delt inn forslagene i tre hovedbolker, hvor en del går på sånn rene skattetekniske endring i skattesystemet vårt for å beskytte skattegrunnlaget bedre. Og så har vi en del som handler mer om offentlig markedsmakt og hvordan vi forvalter SPU og utøver det statlige eierskapet. Så det en tredje del som handler om kontroll og finansiell åpenhet, som også veldig, veldig relevant for det som dreier seg om kriminalitetsbekjempelse. Og der vi opptatt av at vi er nødt til å begynne å regulere det vi kaller for tilretteleggerindustrien på en bedre måte. Og da vi på disse store revisjons- og rådgivningsselskapene, vi på forretningsadvokatene og deres taushetsplikt, og vi på det manglende ansvaret disse tilretteleggerne har for å rapportere og bidra til at det mulig å kontrollere den aktiviteten som foregår.
Oliver Bollow, som du sier, har jo et perspektiv som kanskje handler enda mer om de store skurkene, men et poeng han hadde når vi snakket med han i stad, var at man har egentlig mange av de reguleringene som trengs. Man trenger, som det heter på engelsk, altså enforcement, at skurkene settes i fengsel. De trenger å straffes. Hva tenker du om det perspektivet?
Jeg jo langt på vei enig, og særlig gitt utgangspunktet han har, hvor han skriver om kriminelle. At det å være kriminell jo per definisjon forbudt, så det ikke lovende egentlig det noe i veien med da. Men jeg ikke helt enig at vi ikke skal tenke nye reguleringer, og særlig da når det kommer til disse tilretteleggerne, altså de som lager disse arrangementene som gjør det mulig å gjemme unna penger. Der mener jeg at det trengs nye reguleringer av typen opplysningsplikt for disse tilretteleggerne. Vi trenger å diskutere hvor langt advokaters taushetsplikt egentlig strekker seg, altså hva det den egentlig skal beskytte. Det jo åpenbart at dersom noen havner i ordentlig trøbbel og må møte i en rettssal, så skal du kunne ha et fortrolig forhold til advokaten din. Men at advokaters taushetsplikt nå jeg med på å legge en sånn sky av hemmelighold over den rådgivningen som foregår rundt hvordan penger skal flyttes, det mener jeg ikke riktig.
Ja, da har vi kommet til slutten av denne podcasten også, Gitt.
Denne også, ja.
Ja. Har du noe å anbefale i dag da?
Ja, jeg tenkte han skal jo til Stavanger.
Bollow?
Ja, og det skal vi også. Vi har faktisk, i tillegg til den boklanseringen der, da, to andre arrangementer på Coconomics i Stavanger.
Som den økonomifestivalen.
Ja. Det et arrangement om den norske drømmen. Det om sosial mobilitet og hvorvidt den blir dårligere eller bedre. Og så det en som heter Stavanger, den progressive byen. Vi har jo snakket om den nye plattformen i Stavanger her tidligere, så da spør vi vel om det kan bli modell for hele landet.
Ja.
Ja, du?
Ja, her kommer en anbefaling som kanskje litt smal, men den bygger litt på den forrige episode om på en måte den som vi snakket litt om den islamske gullalderen og sånt, så kom jeg på, det jo en podcast jeg egentlig har hørt ganske mye på, en filosofipodcast som heter History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps, som har en god del episoder om islamsk filosofi. Sånn at hvis det noen som har lyst til å ta et lite dypdykk videre i hva denne islamske gullalderen gikk ut på, og hva man tenkte da, så er det absolutt å anbefale. Det er ikke så sært som det høres ut som, men det er faktisk ganske morsom, han podcast-verten i den podcasten.
Ja, bra og relevant.
Ja.
Ja. Ok, takk for oss for denne gang.
Takk for oss.